Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That felt like a spy movie, where you're close to the world coming to an end.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. We continue Stefan's story where he tells of serving in three armies. We start the episode in the autumn of 1989, where demonstrations are growing against the government in nearby Leipzig, and Stefan's unit is on high alert and confined to barracks. It is clear that East Germany is on the cusp of change. However, what will be the impact on Stefan and his comrades? He describes these tense days when rumours abounded of military action against the demonstrators, as well as how he heard about the fall of Honecker and the opening of the border. We also hear about his experiences as the NVA transitions after the first free elections in East Germany and momentum builds for reunification. Stefan accepts a place in the new unified German army, and we hear about the momentous day when command is handed over to the Bundeswehr and how he has to learn a different way of thinking, such as the new doctrine of personal responsibility. The battle to preserve Cold War history is ongoing, and your support can provide me with the ammunition to continue to keep this podcast on the air. Via a simple monthly donation, you'll become one of our community and get a sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
My name is Mark Franks, and I served in the Royal Air Force from 1982 through to 2007. What I find fascinating about Cold War Conversations are the stories and opinions of those that lived the other side of the Iron Curtain over that period. Keep up the good work and all that you do at Cold War Conversations.
If a monthly contribution is not your cup of tea, we also welcome one-off donations via coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Stefan to our Cold War Conversation.
From one of the first day of October, when we were put on high alert, so basically none of the conscripts were able to leave the barracks anymore, and the officers were like, they couldn't leave their hometown anymore. So there was, you know, tension arising everywhere, and it was very clear that something was going on. And everybody who went home to visit their family came back with these messages saying, "Have you heard that? And have you heard that?" And then on 7th of October, which was probably one of the most critical days, and there was clearly something going on with the Monday demonstration. I think they must have been in the tens of thousands at this point in time in Leipzig. So it was clear something would happen. At least that's what we thought. And we also had some contacts into other barracks near us, which had way more people than us. And we were told by them that actually they had the trucks lined up near the barracks, which would normally they would not do, right? They would get it out of the garage for some education or whatever, but not, you know, on a regular evening or so. And they had lined up their trucks and even handed out the weapons, but without ammunition, which was also kind of strange, because normally when you go on some education trip or so, they would hand you out the weapons and then take the ammunition as one big bucket into the truck. And then whatever you did, shooting education or so, you would get your ammunition, your personal one. But at this point, at least that's what we were told, I did not see this with my own eyes. So trucks were lined up. People were still in their rooms in the barracks, and weapons were handed out, but nothing else happened. And that must have been the night when I was on duty, actually, one of these 24-hour shifts. I was getting a call that in one of these situation rooms, a phone was broken. So I had to go there and exchange the phone or try to fix it. So I was going over there. And my heart, of course, was beating, right? I mean, it was always a strange situation to be called into one of these general's offices. Although I have to say, it's probably the same nowadays. The higher the rank, the more friendly and intelligent the people tend to be. So I had besides many fears, I had no real negative experiences with them. But again, you know, given the actual situation of we knew what the GDR looked like, and being called into the situation room, that was a strange thing. And when I came in there, it was indeed like sort of again like a spy movie, right? I entered the room and I saw, I don't know, maybe 20 or so generals sitting around maps, what turned out to be the city of Leipzig. And they were basically moving around what looked like tin soldiers on, you know, with long sticks and moving them from here to there. So I did not spend long enough time to actually find out what's going on. But I believe from what I saw that they were sort of planning how the army should engage in the city of Leipzig. You know, that together with the fact that the trucks were out in the neighbor barracks, I think there was some planning, or at least some game they or some preparation they were doing, if they would be called to take the army out into the streets. And so I was there for a couple of minutes. I was able to fix the phone and went out again. But that was like felt like a spy movie, where you're close to the world coming to an end.
Was there any point at which it sounded like you might be called out to assist in putting down these demonstrations or anything like that?
So I remember having chatted about this with my comrades. So two of them were friends. I knew them pretty well. One had left in summer 88. So we had this discussion among us. And I remember that we came to the conclusion, if anything like that would happen, we would be probably the last being called, because of, you know, the role we played in the communication system and maintenance, all of that. So there were so many more people, you know, sadly more educated in whatever, you know, running weapons or driving cars or whatever than we were. And we weren't easily replaceable. Of course, everybody's replaceable, but not, you know, if you have a choice of people. And I think the NVA had like, was it like 100,000 people or so under weapons or so? It was quite a lot of people for a small country. So we figured, you know, the risk of us being personally involved is probably pretty low at this point in time. That was more like something I thought about when I considered, like, you know, in this day in 88 in spring, when before I signed, I considered, you know, what is it when they ask you to go to the border? What am I going to do then? But in 89 in Leipzig, no, I did not fear that.
Maybe you didn't have this conversation, but did you talk with your friends as to, if you were asked to shoot at GDR citizens, what you would have done?
Yeah, that was discussed not at this time, but before that, long before that, just as a, you know, general like water cooler type discussion. You know, what do you think about this? What about that? And that was also something you were trying to, you know, have a very private setting for these kind of conversations, you know, because of the risk of Stasi and, or even somebody, you know, regular involved with the party who would basically could cause you trouble. For me, I think that was also something that as an answer I saw from others. Maybe I even took from others. My sort of naive thinking was, okay, if I was forced in a situation like that, you know, and I knew I was getting in trouble for not shooting, I would probably try to shoot, like, you know, and not hit the person that I was asked to shoot or so. That was, I think, a common way of, at least in advance, trying to deal with a situation like that. I know from books and others that you would also get into trouble finally, especially when you were at the border and you were sort of accused of actually intentionally not hitting that person. But at least until then, you know, that was my abstract thinking, like, if I'm really forced, I would probably try to not hit that person. That was my sort of strategy there.
As we move into November, when did you hear the news that Honecker had gone? Can you remember?
Yeah, not the date, but I know the situation very well, because it must have been a Saturday, because there was this kind of, you know, there was this attempt of the GDR leadership to what they called Wende, right? There was this famous saying by the new leader Egon Krenz: "Wir werden die Wende einleiten." We will make a change. And that was already laughable at this time. They're trying to stay in control for them, but and part of that program, and it, you know, with all this time, it feels like what was maybe 4 weeks or 8 weeks, it feels like there was a whole year of things happening. But one of these things they did was they either promoted more, or maybe even founded. Maybe they just promoted more, like kind of youth TV program that had been on and off for, I think, maybe since summer '88 or so, but certainly in '89 they gave that. It was called 1199, which turned out to be the postcode for where the studios were, and. You know, it felt like MTV to us, right? Young people, lots of music, and fresh looks, and all of that. And they were actually changing their role through October and November '89, and becoming more like questioning things like, you know, Wandlitz, or where most of Honecker and others were living. And one of these programs on a Saturday, I think they were on Saturday, was actually when I saw that the wall came down. So I think it was not the day. It must have been like 2 or 3 days later. So I obviously, in that night when this happened, we were, I think a friend of us were calling us through the regular military line. One of us had a friend in I think in Berlin or so, and they were calling us through the open line saying, you know, have you heard this and have you heard that? So it was not how I learned to know that the wall came down, but certainly all of the details, like, you know, what's on TV and you know, seeing the pictures and all of that, that must have been through F996, so through 1199 that I saw that.
So you remember hearing about the wall opening. Was that the next day you heard about that?
It was not very long after. Maybe not in the same night, but maybe the day after. Not very long after.
What is the atmosphere in those days after the wall has opened?
At least twofold, maybe even more, sort of categories of thinking. There was, of course, a lot of people who were just, you know, going out saying, now we're free and, you know, the world belongs to us and all of that. I was more sort of held back about this, because I couldn't make up my mind what this really means. You know, I was 19 at this time. I didn't know that much about international politics, and I just, the only thing that I sort of that stuck with me during maybe November or even a little bit before that, was there was this idea of, you know, having a better GDR. That was certainly something that I found interesting. And I wasn't one of these people who immediately thought, okay, now I can go to West Berlin, or, you know, leave the GDR for West Germany or whatever. That was not on my mind. But I was more held back. And then, of course, there was the third category. People in you know, fear and confusion. Like most of the officers and personnel that was there for a long time, they didn't understand what's going on at all. They were way more confused than I was. And I think at this point, at least, I didn't meet many people who were very clear on what's going to happen. I mean, and who could have told, right? So. It was mostly confusion. So does it mean we are also allowed to go to West Berlin or West Germany? Or, you know, there were these days when they were trying to still ask you would have to get a passport and you have to get stamped. And that very quickly stopped because it was, you know, ridiculous. But within the NVA, I think there was very quickly these three, at least what I perceive, these three categories of people, like me being like sort of, you know, very, very held back and trying to get, trying to understand what's going on. And then there were these people who were trying to leave as much as soon as possible. And then those who just didn't know what's going on.
When was the first time you actually crossed into the West?
I think that must have been certainly in winter, maybe even 89. But there was one situation when people were taking the train going to Bavaria, to Bayreuth and Nuremberg. And there was a situation in Leipzig when there was some casualties, maybe even some people going dead because there were too many people waiting for the train. And that was the moment when my dad actually offered me, you know, if you want to go, since you're in Leipzig, but you better come to me, take my car and, you know, take the car going to Bayreuth and collect your Begrüßungsgeld and all of that. Because, you know, they feared I would be in a similar situation. So I think it was maybe in November or December 89.
And what was your first impression of the West?
It smelled like one of these Intershop shops.
So it smelled of Levi jeans and bottles of Johnny Walker whiskey
and chocolate and soap and all of that, right? So there was this when we were getting parcels from West Germany, there was a certain smell to them, and you know, of course, all of the you know, everybody was excited to open what's in there. And there was a similar smell when you went to the Intershop, and when we went to Bayreuth to get there. It was incredible how efficient the West Germans were. Like, you know, these millions of people collecting 100 Deutschmark each, and there was no signs of stress anywhere, right? They were just handling that, and they had buses taking you from the train station to somewhere else where you would get the money, and there were shops springing up here and there selling you things, and there was this chocolate and all of that. There was just there was no chaos. Everything was like very professional and very German, really.
As 1989 closes, GDR is still there. The structure of government is still there. But as you move into the early months of 1990, it starts falling away at that point. Would that be a correct view?
Yeah, I think that's true for both, you know, the NVA as well as the rest of the GDR. Obviously at this time I was still, you know, fully engaged in the, like, you know, as the sort of conscript with all the contractual obligations. And but then of course, you know, we very quickly they allowed us to leave every night and even, you know, sleep outside the barracks as long as we did our job, so to say. And but what you could very closely see is that the same sort of confusion and the same sort of people, you know, trying to leave as much as soon as possible, the same thing was going on in the rest of the GDR as well. So that was kind of a similar happening going on. And the other thing that I realized also during this time, I was getting way more interested, obviously, way more interested into what's going on, you know, in terms of politics and the outside world and everything. And like I said before, this idea of, you know, having a better society and, you know, trying something that hasn't been done before in the GDR was intriguing to me. And that was the sort of the idea of, you know, what these people were looking for in 89. And I found this interesting, but more like I started to think about it when, you know, I saw that happening and was way more involved in reading about this in the end of 89. But I also started to you know, visit some of these Monday demonstrations. It must have been maybe in the end of October. So it was surely before the wall came down, but it was certainly not you know, like this forbidden situation that you would risk of being in jail for being there or so. That I was not crazy enough for that. But so I visited these Monday demonstrations a couple of times between, maybe mid October, and then I think the last one I was on was in early February or so, And you could see a change every week. And in the beginning, it was more subtle. And then it turned out to be much more quicker and more like bigger steps were taken. So there was a lot. You could see like the, you know, the flags were people were holding up and, you know, all the transparency and everything, you know, with all these sometimes very thoughtful texts they had put on. And also what people were shouting. And you could see that slightly changing every week. So in the beginning, it was about, you know, us being free and the freedom of thought and freedom of expression. And then it turned into freedom of travel. And I think travel was also a very important part in the very beginning. And then suddenly I heard, I think it must have been even maybe end of November or so, certainly in December, when there were people starting to ask for German reunification. I think it must have been, like I said, maybe late November. And you could see that as a regular visitor, right? You could see that it's getting more like, before that it was mostly, if you could see a flag of East Germany, it was without the emblem, so it was cut out. But then you could see more and more like the regular West German flag coming in and people asking, even can't remember if this was a topic in 89, but certainly in 1990 when they were asking for the D-Mark and all of that stuff that happened afterwards. And I personally stopped going there in February when Helmut Kohl was visiting Leipzig, and they had one of these huge demonstrations where, again, like 300,000 people or so, and they were seriously handing out bananas to people coming to the CDU truck, and that was the end for me, right? I thought, okay, now it's lovable what they do here, and it was no longer about freedom, it was no longer about ideas, it was just about this stuff.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Because you had these groups like Neues Forum, mm-hmm. who were looking at sort of like a middle way between the communism of the SED and the capitalism of the West. But eventually they were subsumed by the huge firepower that parties like the CDU and the SPD brought in, that completely overwhelmed them with promises of loads of money and a golden future. I mean, did you feel as though you were being occupied, is probably the wrong word, but being absorbed into West Germany? Did you still feel that you had an East German identity? Did you consider yourself German?
Oh, no, that took a long time for me to consider myself a German. No, at this point, maybe even until, I don't know, 91 or so, when it was really my idea that this is now, you know, our Germany and such. That took a long time. But in early 1990s, certainly it was all about the GDR, at least for me, and having this, you know, what they called the third way. And you know what you said, like Neues Forum. I was not involved with these groups, but the idea was intriguing to me, right? I thought this is an excellent way. I mean, being 19, you know, you're all about doing crazy experiments and all of that. So that was something that was intriguing to me. So it was certainly about there was a chance for at least an experiment, maybe even something that would turn out to be successful. But it was pretty clear to me that with the changing attitude of people every Monday, that this was off the table pretty quickly, right? The people voted with their feet, and they were clearly preferring like the short-term things or whatever long-term could have happened. And so it turned out to be actually a good idea that sort of the professionals took over, because when in 1991 there was this thing going on in Moscow when Yeltsin was the
coup.
Exactly.
Then
there was another. That was sort of my last fear within the army, but yeah, not yet.
And so, when reunification is announced as sort of like a possibility, which I think was March 1990.
Yes. So looking at it from the NVA perspective, I think the first thing that happened that was interesting is that we were sworn in again, right? So when you were starting your army thing, you had to swear an oath that you would fight for communism until the end of your life or whatever that was. And I think the Communist Party was a big part of that. I think it was in March 1990 that we were sworn in again, and this time to the constitution of the GDR, which was totally it had existed forever since the GDR was born, but it didn't play a big role in everyday life. And now there was this the ceremony again that we were getting new symbols on our uniforms. We no longer had this hammer. What's that called? Hammer
and compasses.
Compasses, yeah.
Hammer and compass, and the wheat sheaf.
Exactly, yeah. Those symbols of the GDR were gone, so we just had we had the colors, and that was all. And we were sworn in again to the constitution of the GDR, and that's when I said, that's the second army I served in. So that's the when things were sort of changing. But it was not yet clear, and it was certainly just starting to be seen that maybe there was a reunification. And actually, before we started here, I reached out to a friend who was with me during this time, and he remembered much better than I did. And he said that the unification treaty actually that was started to negotiate between the GDR and West Germany, that was actually where it was ruled, how things are moving forward for NVA and all of that. So it took a while until there was a sort of a perspective on who would continue as what, and would there be another NVA, or would there be only Bundeswehr, or would there even be reunification? There was lots of things being discussed, and it can't exactly tell when everything was clear, but maybe during summer or so, but maybe not before that.
And what's happening with your role at this point? Because you were supposed to be signed up to 91, weren't you?
Yes. My personal plan had been, certainly from the very beginning, because there was all still GDR, I had been, offered these three things that turned out to be true. And also part of that was that I was able to sign up for my studies already in 88. So I basically had the registration for starting in 1991 at the university in Chemnitz, in my hometown. For me, the question was really, should I just exit, which was possible then. Everybody who was who had more than 18 months in whatever role were basically free to leave. For many personal reasons, it sounded interesting to me to continue there. And also, I just enjoyed that job, right? I mean, I had a couple of friends there. Later on, I even had a flat in Leipzig. Well, I just lived like a regular person, and it was more like an office job. You enter the barracks in the morning, you do your thing, and at 5 or 6, you go home and have some more fun. So the job itself was fun. I had friends there. So there was no real pressure for me to actually having to leave. And job-wise, it was actually still the same, right? You know, we still had the same phone system. And even when it started that you could see some Bundeswehr trucks or cars like visiting, obviously, you know, planning how to hand over things to Bundeswehr. Even then, I thought this is something that may be interesting until the end of my 3 years.
I mean, that must have been really strange to see Bundeswehr vehicles in and around your barracks and that red beret of Bundeswehr troops. Could you remember when you first saw these troops and sort of just thought, my goodness, the world has turned on its head, I would imagine?
I don't think it was that much of a big deal for me because I never saw West Germany as the enemy, right? So I know other people, for them it was unbearable, right? We had rarely seen in any of the educations, we had rarely seen pictures of NATO soldiers or so. At least I did not, maybe also because I wasn't involved with a lot of weapon stuff and such. Maybe those people had more pictures or whatever they would look out for. But for me, I never saw that. And it was more like it wasn't against the enemy, but it was more like, yeah, you know, this is the reason we need to run these phone lines. And that was that. So yes, it was strange to see Bundeswehr cars on in our barracks, but it wasn't as earth-shattering as you would think. So, I mean, at this time, so many things were changing anyway. We were, you know, getting D-Mark at the beginning of July in 1990. So there were so many things. I think I found it stranger to see Westmark in our barracks than the actual Bundeswehr cars.
What were your commanders telling you about what your position was going to be after reunification?
Yeah, so that was, again, something that I had discussed with my friend because I didn't have that much memory about this. But apparently, the unification treaty actually ruled that everyone who was serving 4 or less years would be taken over into the Bundeswehr if they wanted to. That was the kind of rule. And everybody was going for more would be under very close scrutiny. And I think only very few of these people were being offered to continue in the Bundeswehr. I know some did, certainly not the majority. And I think anything from major even upwards was also not, at least not taken over in general. Maybe some individuals, but not in general. So there was, it unfolded, I think during summer or so that it was clear that I could stay if I wanted to. There wasn't not a lot of details, I believe. Yeah, we didn't get any information about you know, things like money or whatever else. It was more like, yeah, you can stay if you like. And the only thing that was pretty clear pretty soon was that our ranks would be cut by one level, so to say. So yeah, I think most people were cut like one of their ranks because it was also more similar to, you know, in terms of responsibility of how the Bundeswehr were running things. But that wasn't that much of a deal for me, so that didn't influence my decision. I think the only really strange thing that was going on was we all also received new uniforms in before the 3rd of October when the Bundeswehr was taking over all of the barracks and everything. And so we received new battle dress and, you know, the beret and new boots, actually much better boots than we had before. Everybody was getting a pocket knife, which is also very funny to see that. And it was also, by the way, this was also a signal, right? So in the NVA, you were always under the impression that nobody's trusting you, at least not from the higher ups. There was always this, like, I talked about the ammunition before, right? It was probably for security reasons that you were only handed out ammunition at the very last moment, even if it was for educational purposes. But it maybe it was also for the reason that nobody trusted you, right? So that's for sure. And then you get into this Bundeswehr thing, and the very first thing they give you is maybe not the biggest knife, but at least something that is, you know, more than you ever had in GDR time. So that was an interesting thing. And what was actually funny was that the only things that we were actually asked to continue using from the NVA are our steel helmet. So that was still the NVA one for at least the 1 year that I served after unification. And also our Kalashnikov rifle. It was, of course, not with us. It was locked away. But everybody had their personal one. And that was the weapon you had to use in case you had to use a weapon.
And was there quite a lot of excitement at getting this new uniform and trying it on and working out what it was all about?
So there were more practical questions like, you know, how are you, you know, which knots would you be using for tying your shoes and this kind of stuff. And then I remember there was the new commander-in-chief was coming in on the 2nd of October, the night before unification. And his driver was basically sleeping in our place, and so we had a chat with him, and that was sort of funny and strange at the same time. And he helped us a lot. I think that night of 2nd October to 3rd October, we learned like a lot of things in the very last minute. You know, how to wear the beret and all of these things. And I don't remember being that much excited particularly. It was really more the practical things that were kind of, you know, what we did there.
Day before, you're parading in East German uniform, and then the day after, you have the red beret and the Bundeswehr
exactly.
uniform. Wow. And was there a taking down of the flag ceremony on that last day?
Yes, I think there was a like they were rolling in the flag, and there was one last you know moment where everybody had to stand in, you know, in line, and sort of this is the end of the GDR, so to say. And I remember that more like a strange or maybe even funny situation. That wasn't much of a ceremony for me, at least, because, you know, everybody knew what was coming. But I think the strangest situation had my friend who was actually on watch during that night, right? So we had in front of the barracks, and he was actually on duty for that. So when he started his I think it was like 24 hours again. So he started that at the end of the day on the 2nd of October. And he started, of course, in his NVA uniform, and then he had his Bundeswehr uniform with him. And in the night, he actually changed clothes, and in the morning, he basically was the Bundeswehr person, so to say. That must have been much more strange than it was for me, right? This is a one of a kind situation.
Incredible. And at that flag ceremony, when it comes down the day before, is that the last time you sang the East German anthem? Was the East German anthem sung at that point or not?
Oh, I don't remember that. Probably not, because things like that already changed. Like when I said, you know, in March, when the that thing in between, that Second Army time began, all these things were toned down a lot, right? What used to be a very important thing, and everybody has to protect the flag under all circumstances, all of that stuff, that was not a topic anymore. That was never discussed. So I don't think we did any singing or so. Maybe somebody was speaking something or so, but it was not a big moment.
Because I've seen film on YouTube, and it might have been more hardcore units of the NVA who had that final parade with the flag, and it was quite a big deal. And I think the anthem was sung on that, but I'll have to have a look at that footage again. I mean, were there some people who were upset on that day?
I don't think so, no.
They'd all gone by that point, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. So I think on the 2nd of October, you would only still have people left who would basically stay on for the new Bundeswehr, right? Everybody else had already left, and either, you know, some people went on pension, and you also had some very sad stories. I think one of the high officers that we had, who was a sharp person and, you know, very correct and was there for a long time, like, you know, 30 years or so, and he ended up as a security guard in a shopping center, you know, like 12 months later or so, somebody met him there. And for them, of course, it was like much harder than it was for me, you know, being 19 and at the start of something exciting, something new.
Because their whole world had just turned over and they no longer had that respect they used to have in society.
And also belief, right? I mean, I met a few people, actually surprisingly few. You would have thought that, you know, there were at least the people in the party would be firm believers in the ideas of socialism and everything. And when you get to know these people, I rarely met, maybe not even 10 people I met who were really believing in the idea of communism and everything, and who really personally were disappointed that now this is an end or so. But most people I knew were either relaxed or even excited about the future that's coming. But this may have been due to the fact that, like I said in the beginning, our battalion was mostly staffed with very young, you know, engineering focused people who were there. Everybody knew we were here for 3 years, and then maybe 20% were officers or so. We didn't have much close contact with them, so that didn't play a role for me, at least.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. Once you're then part of the Bundeswehr, is that when your new training in their ethos and this inner Führung quality, this inner leadership, or this policy of personal responsibility starts to get trained?
Yes, indeed. That was pretty soon after. So we had a new commander and a new deputy from 3rd of October, basically, right? So we on 2nd of October, there was this like final ceremony, and on 3rd of October, the new guy came in and, you know, hello, and that's me, and let's talk, and all of that. Way more human than the GDR leaders were behaving, at least in the ranks we were involved with. And also, I mean, a Bavarian accent, right? That's another thing that was really strange for me, at least, to hear from these people. And very quickly, it turned out that humanity is something that is held very highly in the Bundeswehr. At least, what, you know, obviously, experiences are different, and there's probably a lot of people having bad experience in the Bundeswehr. But for me, having been exposed to what we, you know, we kept on joking in GDR times, we get irradiation of red light all the time, right? So like this indoctrination of communist idea, and, you know, we're here to save the world, and all of the, nobody believed in that. At least I did not. So it was just boring stuff you had to sit through. And then basically in the same room, like a year later, somebody else was sitting there, and again, let's talk about the Constitution, and, you know, what are your responsibilities as a soldier in under the Constitution of Bundesrepublik Deutschland. And that was strange in the beginning to get this kind of, you know, in a similar setting, to get also to talk about this similar things, but it became pretty pretty soon it became clear that there's much more reality in what's being discussed here. And it was also way more practical, right? You know, I think pretty soon we discussed like what are situations when you actually asked to not follow orders, right? When you are not allowed to follow orders, stuff like that, which would never been if possible to even touch that topic in the GDR. There was an order was like, you know, always an order. There was no way to even think about discussing that. And so, yeah, that was pretty clear pretty soon that at least personally, I'm not sure if that was a strategic mission that the Bundeswehr was trying to drive in with the rest of the NVA that stayed. But talking about the constitution and what it means to be a soldier and, like you said, innere Führung, all these principles, that was, to me, looking back, a very good idea. Because while the contrast to the GDR was funny in the beginning, it was also helpful looking back to see immediately, you know, after the reunification, okay, this is what is different, right? And that led to resolve a lot of the chaos and uncertainty. And you got to see, okay, this is at least what's on paper, and all of the like people, how people acted and what you were being asked to do and such. There was a lot more integrity between the constitution and the laws and everything and everyday life. That was a pretty good experience for me.
I think, you know, when we were chatting before we recorded this, you mentioned to me that, you know, you had one-to-ones with your commander, which would have been unheard of in the NVA.
Yeah. Sort of being treated as an equal human, right? And you could talk to them and really feel like asking everything. I had much more trust in doing that with the Bundeswehr commander than I would have had with the NVA commander. Maybe also because of the, you know, almost 3 years that I had served until, you know, and I mean, these were formative years for me in the age between 18 and 21. There's a lot of development that you make personally. So maybe that was also an aspect that played a role here. But of course, you know, also the personality of people, but that was certainly a contrast.
And were you trained on completely new equipment at that point, or what was going on as far as your role?
I don't think my sort of day job ever changed that much during these 3 years, because Bundeswehr was taking over most of the communication lines, at least at this point. I later visited that place again. I still had some friends there, and they showed me the new thing. What used to be like three rooms full of equipment was now like, you know, one corner of an office. And of course, that was funny to see, which meant, you know, way less maintenance and, you know, all sorts of other things. But I think at least until I left, which was in August 91, at least until then, most of the of that technology, like communication lines and all of that, stayed mostly the same. Obviously, the ones going into Moscow were used less, and there were new ones going to Bonn and Berlin, but that part stayed mostly the same.
Because the Soviet army was still in East Germany at that point, but starting to pack up and leave.
That's true. And to be honest, we didn't have a lot of connection with them, right? I mean, we had, obviously, we knew where, since I was in the open part of the battalion, we communicated a lot with Deutsche Post. So there were open lines, and we always had this, like, the real names of the cities these lines were going to. And that was something that was not used in the normal GDR, NVA communication. There was always like these secret names of things, and you were not supposed to say, like, you know, this is in Delitzsch and this is in Dresden. You would have to say that, like, the secret name of that. So when there was communication with the Russians, it was probably more in the encrypted section, and I didn't get to see that much. And that was, of course, all torn down in like very early 1990, when they the equipment, I think, was mostly Russian, and the Russians took that with them very early on, just to make sure it's not getting into the hands of NATO.
What's happening with your parents at this point? Have they still got their jobs, or are they seeing you know, redundancies or anything like that?
So my parents got divorced shortly before the wall came down. So that was a lot of change for them anyway, for both of them, right? So that's intermixed with whatever happens during this time. But my dad actually, I think it was even in early 1990, he changed his jobs again. In the institution where he was working, they were looking for basically new leaders that do not have any party history, and you know, certainly not any Stasi connections. And so he was actually promoted pretty quickly within that institution, and because he basically was like free of any problems there. And so he went on quickly after that. I think in 1991 or so, he moved into the Ministry of Education in Dresden. And my mom actually was involved with one of the daughter companies of Treuhand after the wall came down. She quickly changed there. So basically all of the buildings and everything that had to be returned to their previous owners, that couldn't be done from one day to the other. So there was some continuation, but any rent collected and any, you know, money that was flowing or so had to be preserved for that moment when you give it back to the previous owner. And she was basically doing the calculations for that kind of stuff. So my parents both actually had a good uneventful way of finding their way around there as well.
And what about your career coming out of, well, you've been through the NVA, you've been in this interim army, and now you're Bundeswehr. The qualifications that you thought were going to be useful, are they worth anything in the new Germany?
certainly not the practical stuff, right? I mean, the old phone systems from 1960 probably couldn't. Maybe you could use them in a museum or so. You know, obviously, like with all of this, like the personal relations and the experiences I had, and looking back into this time, the friendship still stays. Like I said, I still have two friends I'm meeting frequently from that time. But apart from that, the other plan worked well as I had thought, right? So in 1991, I started to do my A-levels because I was doing this apprenticeship. I didn't have the right to study. So I was doing 1 year of preparation to get my A-levels, and then started to study in 1992 and graduated from Hochschule Mittweida, which is a small town near Chemnitz, in 1996. Yep. Almost as planned.
Yeah, just a small matter of a country disappearing in the meantime.
Yeah, but, indeed.
I mean, how did you feel that last day in the Bundeswehr? Did you feel sad that you were leaving that life, or were you just looking forward?
So for me, it was always sort of that day was 3 years in the making, right? So I had planned to do it that way, it was always clear that there would be an end in to that situation by August 1991. And as I indicated earlier, there was one moment of, you know, holding your breath in summer 1991. From that moment that Helmut Kohl was in Leipzig in early 1990, I was sort of disgusted, right? How those people treated us, and how some of my fellow GDR citizens are actually behaving, and you know what they're looking for, all of that. So I wasn't too fond of Helmut Kohl becoming the Chancellor of the Unification, all of that. But then when that coup was going on in Moscow, and you know, it was on the table that the military is taking over and all of that, that was during like literally my last days in the Bundeswehr. And I was actually, for the first time, I was thinking, thank God that this unification is all completed, and you know, now it's clear that there's one Germany. Before that, I was thinking, you know, maybe we should have taken things more slowly, and would have been easier for the people moving over, and maybe more jobs could have been kept and all of that. But politically, I think it was the right move, and I didn't see that before. That he always said, like, you know, the historic hour of, you know, if it's possible and all of that. But indeed, I have to say, after all these years, there was this danger that if the military would have taken over and they were still deep in the GDR in 91, they could have closed the border, right? They could have reestablished GDR very quickly and everything would have come to an end. So I think that moment was, and it actually resolved also during August 91. So when I left Leipzig, everything was good again. Of course, you know, you're leaving friends and all of that. That was the sad part. But looking forward and, you know, knowing that my studies are going to be starting and all of that, I was looking forward to do the next thing. So that was not sad at all.
Looking back at your time in the NVA, was there anything that you think that the NVA did better than the Bundeswehr?
One of the major differences I saw, I mean, obviously, you know, when you say what they did better is, you know, better from what perspective, right? I mean, obviously they were not treating people better and so lots of stuff. But I think if you look at it from a military perspective, the organization of the NVA was much more strict and much more focused on having a quick reaction. So the fear was always that West Germany would, you know, start the tanks and roll over East Germany in whatever, 3 days or so, right? So everything was focused on being on alert and being able to being ready to react within N hours or N days or so. And, you know, within 2 weeks, they would have mobilized like another 2 million people. And within 6 hours, the rockets would be ready, whatever it was. And, I think this part, quick reaction and having people sort of always be ready to react, that was something that the GDR did much more strict. Of course, at an enormous cost. So they built houses. I think the Bundeswehr did that as well. Built housing close to the barracks so that the officers are living nearby. All of the marriages that were going wrong of the officers because they were moving every 2 years to a new place and their wives could not find friends and all that stuff is probably the sad prices people had to pay for this kind of situation. But if you look at this just solely from this angle, that's probably something that the GDR and NVA did more strict and maybe more efficiently. I don't know.
I mean, when I talk to the Bricksmiths guys, the military liaison mission guys, you know, one of the things they have always said is they thought the NVA was far more professional than the Soviet Army. And certainly in readiness is one of the things they have talked about, that the readiness levels were much higher and they were far more difficult to get information from as well.
Hmm.
Whereas a Soviet might be much more easily bribed.
I could see that very well. The Russians were just poor people, right? I mean, the few moments I had to see how they lived and all of that, this was unbelievably bad.
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.